Welcome to Christchurch London, a community looking to make a difference in the heart of London. This is a message from one of our Sunday celebrations. Thanks for tuning in, and do check out our website at www.christchurchlondon.org.
Great to see you all. It's wonderful to be back from my holes. Ooh, was that you, Andy? He's such an easy target. I'd like to share with you three things that I've learnt this summer. The first is about W.H. Smith's. The second is about the rising price of electricity. And the third is about internet access at Butlins Bognor. Is that okay? If you're new, this is the sort of thing I do at the start. Firstly then, at the start of the summer holidays, I asked Esther, who's 8, and Bethany, who's 7, if Daddy promised to take you anywhere in the whole world for a treat, you know, one-on-one with Daddy, where would you want to go? And I'm expecting they're going to say, you know, like Disneyland Paris or Alton Towers. But they both say, we'd like to go to W.H. Smith's. And I was thinking, result. I mean, that is so much cheaper, don't you think? So then I ask, hang on, what do you want to do, or what do you want to buy in W.H. Smith's? And they said, well, we don't want to buy anything. We just want to sort of hang out in W.H. Smith's. And it turns out, right, that when you're 8, and if you're a girl, the place to hang out is W.H. Smith's. I mean, did you know that? I didn't know that. For me, this was a huge discovery. I mean, I get the fact that when you're 8, you can't hang out in a lot of places. You can't exactly hang out down the pub. Or if you did that, would raise a lot of questions about the parenting. But apparently, W.H. Smith's is the place, and I didn't know that. Anyway, that was my first thing. So, did you know that? No, it's not just me. Very good. And so anyway, I asked, look, what is there to do in W.H. Smith's? And then they just started listing all the departments of W.H. Smith. And I'm thinking, departments at W.H. Smith? As far as I can remember, W.H. Smith is a shop that you go to for stationery, birthday cards, and those like lever arch files, you know, when you're doing your A-levels, you want to hole punch everything, and you put them all in there. You know, that's basically what you're going to W.H. Smith's for. But I can tell you, it was never a very exciting shop, but I've discovered that W.H. Smith has changed. Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of departments in there. So anyway, I spent a large part of my August in W.H. Smith. That was my first discovery. Second thing, the rising price of electricity. Now, yeah, exactly. Julia, my wife, feels that I waste electricity unnecessarily. You know, by leaving lights on around the house and so on. And technically, she's right. But she's gone out and she's got this display screen gadget thing that is in our kitchen, and it says all the time at any given moment how much money in pounds and sterling you are spending if you were to carry on right now with the appliances you've got on right now. And so you walk in the kitchen, you know, the lights are off, everything's switched off. You look at the screen, it says, Adrian, everything's okay. Just keep it like this. You're only spending 17 pence a day. But then you switch the lights on, you start boiling the kettle. It says, mate, watch out. You carry on like this, you're going to be spending £175 a day. Now, I didn't know that. If you boil and reboil the kettle all day, you're like literally on and off with all the lights on, it's £175 a day. So the price of electricity is definitely going up. I didn't know that. Did you know that? Oh, you knew that. Okay. Here's my last, final thing. We went to Butlins Bognor for a week, where, incidentally, you can watch live on stage every night the losing X Factor finalists. And anyway, they've got internet access in every single chalet. Now, okay, Shoreline Hotel and Deluxe Villas on Yachtsman's Drive, no surprises there. But even in gold, standard, and even silver plus, even standard class accommodation, you can still get broadband. And so, on holiday, I was able to access iTunes and download every single sermon from our Joseph series in August that I'd missed. How wonderful that was. And so, I've listened to James Haslam, Pete Mack, Ross Bull, Uncle Rhys Scott, all of which have been brilliant. And today, I've been asked to finish off the series. Today, we get to Genesis chapter 50 and the end of the book of Genesis. And today, we're going to see in verse 20 of chapter 50, if you have a Bible, we're going to study perhaps the greatest example in the whole of the Old Testament of what I'm going to call total forgiveness. Tonight, folks, we're going to see that there's something beyond saying, I forgive you. There's something beyond saying, I forgive you, and meaning it, and then praying for the person. There's something, in fact, several steps even beyond that before you get to totally forgive someone who has deeply offended you and you genuinely set them free. And in chapter 50 of Genesis, we see Joseph scale those heights. We see the climax of Joseph's life as Joseph reaches the summit of godly maturity. He succeeds in doing the hardest thing that any of us are ever called to do. Joseph demonstrates total forgiveness. And I want to ask you guys straight up, is there anyone who you have yet to totally forgive? Because until you totally forgive that person, whilst there is still some bitterness and some resentment inside you, there is poison in your system. And tonight, I'm going to ask you to do yourself a favor, to forgive totally, to do what Joseph did and to totally set the other person free. And if you do, you will experience a new freedom. Now, before we look at our text, let's just remind ourselves of the outrageous injustices that Joseph had suffered. Firstly, his brothers tried to kill him because they hated him. Now, of course, if you don't know the story, and there will be many people here tonight who are coming in for the first time and don't know the story, you might ask, yeah, but maybe Joseph deserved it. Maybe this Joseph guy did something really evil. But Joseph's crime was that he told his brothers, hey, guess what? I had this really cool dream, right, where you guys, you all fell down and bowed at my feet. Isn't that cool? Which is annoying, isn't it? But if I had shared a couple of annoying dreams with my brothers, and they had decided to murder me as a result, personally, I would have considered that a little bit of an overreaction. And here's the brothers' response. They saw him, Joseph, in the distance, and plotted to kill him. They said to each other, oh, let's kill him and throw him into one of these here cisterns. Then they realized that maybe the death penalty is a little bit OTT, so in their mercy, in their kindness, they decide to only sell Joseph into slavery. Now think of how annoying or immature your brother was when he was 17. He was a pain, wasn't he? But you didn't actually sell him into slavery, did you? You thought about it. You wanted to. But when push came to shove and your mum was in the next door bedroom, you didn't actually do it. These guys do sell their brother into slavery for 20 shekels of silver. They sold their own flesh and blood. They made money out of selling their brother Joseph. And I don't know, maybe their wives got suspicious the following week. Hey, Simeon, how come you can suddenly afford to order in pizza every night of the week? They might have said. And Simeon replies, dear, that's a very good question. We found 20 shekels of silver down the back of the sofa. They lied, in other words. They made up a story. They sold their brother into slavery and lied about it. And then they lied to their own father, saying that Joseph was dead. They said, it was terrible. Father, a wild animal killed him. It was really scary. We had absolutely nothing to do with that. There was a lot of blood and gore. It was awful. But it was nothing to do with us, but he's dead. And even then, any day, I don't know, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, 5 years later, on any given day, one of the 11 brothers could have said, hey, you know what, Dad? It was a lie. I'm so sorry we lied to you. We made the whole story up. Joseph isn't dead. We sold him into slavery. Any given day they could have told the truth, but they never did. They never did the decent thing. They never owned up. Joseph suffered appalling injustices, and the worst of it was that it was at the hands of his own family. Anyway, he ends up, as you may know, working for Potiphar. He serves Potiphar brilliantly. He does Potiphar no wrong, But Potiphar's wife accuses Joseph of attempting to rape her. Joseph is totally innocent, but Potiphar nevertheless throws Potiphar in prison. There he meets Pharaoh's cupbearer, and Joseph interprets the cupbearer's dream. Pharaoh's cupbearer gets out of prison. Things are looking up. Pharaoh's cupbearer promises to plead Joseph's case and try and get Joseph out of prison, but the cupbearer forgets, and Joseph stays in prison for a further 2 years. And so when Joseph finally does meet his brothers in Genesis chapter 45, you would expect Joseph to be hopping mad, but he's not. Amazing. He forgives them. But as we come to our passage tonight, it's 17 years later, and sadly, the brothers are still lying. Jacob, their father, has just died, and here is what happens next. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, oh, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph, boys. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now, please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. There is no record of Jacob ever saying any such thing. This is a lie. The brothers are scared witless. The old man's dead. Joseph's got in him for us. So they revert to panic mode. They start lying again. And Joseph knows that they're lying. And so when their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him, thus fulfilling the dream way back in Genesis 37. It comes true right here. We are your slaves, they said. At which point Joseph could have replied, yes, and you should be my slaves because you lot ruined my life. You sold me into slavery. You made me live my whole life in a country I didn't even want to be in. I was in prison. I was homeless. I was a slave. I was accused of rape. I missed my 20s. You separated me from my dad for 22 years. All the time you made him think that I was dead. My own mother died, and I didn't get to go to the funeral. I didn't get to say goodbye to her. But even after all of that, 17 years ago, I forgave you. And since then, I've fed you, I've fed your kids, I've fed your families, I've housed you, I've cared for you, only to find that all these years later, you lot are still lying to me, and you're still trying to deceive me, he could have said. But instead of saying that, he says one of the most sublime sentences in the whole Old Testament. He says this, Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish. What's happening now? What's now being done? The saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Wow. Wow. So let's look tonight, folks, at what total forgiveness really is. And this is no ordinary subject. This is no ordinary service. Because totally forgiving the person or the people who've offended you could be the most important thing that God has ever called you to do. You could be on the brink right now tonight without realizing it when you came into this place. You could be on the brink of a significant breakthrough that will affect the whole of the rest of your life. So let's look at total forgiveness. First, he says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Now, why is this significant? Well, until you've totally forgiven the other person, you want them to be afraid. You want them to be afraid. You want them to be anxious. You don't want them to get away with what they did to you. So if they are feeling nervous about what some of the potential repercussions might be, you're thinking, good. Total forgiveness is when you don't want the other person to feel guilty at all anymore. You don't want the other person to pay at all for what they did to you. Now let's be honest. Your bitterness right now seems reasonable, seems justifiable. In the light of what that person did to you, it's hardly surprising that you feel bitter, and everybody here will probably agree with you if you explain the circumstances. But here's the deal. Your bitterness isn't damaging anyone except you. You are not actually getting back at that person at all by feeling bitter. You're not actually hurting them. The only person you're hurting is yourself. Or in my case, I usually also hurt my wife and my kids, because when I'm holding on to bitterness, there's a pretty bad atmosphere around the house. And so my kids and my wife suffer unfairly because of my selfish choice to hold on to my feelings of bitterness. And I've learned that if I allow any bitterness to stay in my heart, I lose peace. And I've come to the conclusion that it's just not worth it. It's not worth it. I'd rather have the peace. So what's the first step? Well, of course, the first step is to you tell God out loud, I forgive so-and-so. And at that stage, you feel nothing. It probably will require a daily commitment at this stage for you to ever develop anything beyond limited or technical forgiveness. You're not really feeling any joy at this stage, at the gritted teeth stage. You're some way off total forgiveness. Next, Joseph says, am I in the place of God? When somebody offends you, the reason it's a problem is because it's personal. And by saying, am I in the place of God, Joseph totally diffuses the tension by showing that he no longer takes the offense personally. In other words, hey guys, there's no need to apologize to me anymore. The offense no longer exists. As far as I'm concerned, you're totally free. He's not going to tell them. But Adrian, to not tell anyone what that other person did to me, to just forgive, that's a massive ask. Now, okay, it does, of course, depend upon what the offense is. There are some offenses that you absolutely must report, and straight away, abuse, rape, and so on. But most of the offenses that we are dealing with in this room tonight, most of the bitterness in this room tonight is not about stuff that really needs to be reported to the police or to the church elders for that matter. It is to do with people who have hurt you in ways that would never lead to a trial or to church discipline. Here's the deal. You hold a grudge against someone. And here is the weird deal with my own unforgiveness. For about 3 years, I genuinely thought, I really, really, truly thought that I had forgiven a certain person, only to realize 3 years later that actually I hadn't totally forgiven them. And I really wish I could have those 3 years back. I mean, lots of good things happened during those 3 years. It wasn't all doom and gloom. But if only I'd been more self-disciplined in my thinking, I could have had so much more peace and joy in those 3 years. And the longer that you've been a Christian, the more embarrassing it becomes to admit that actually you do have unforgiveness in your heart, even though you've been a Christian for all this time. So let's be a little bit more specific. The offenses that most usually hurt us are from those people who are closest to us, or from people from whom we had reason to expect something better. In other words, that equals a Christian. Am I right? Talk to me. Okay. Here's the most likely person, the most typical person that you have yet to totally forgive. A Christian in church, this church or some other church, who was close to you, and at this moment, they don't think that they have done anything wrong at all. That's why it's so annoying. I remember making a classic mistake on this one that I'm sure all of you will easily avoid. But when I first became a Christian, I went on this missionary trip to a Muslim country. And there was this one guy on the missionary team who really got on my nerves. And I just struggled to be in the same room as this guy. And then, of course, I felt guilty because I thought, oh, good gracious, I'm a Christian now, and we're on a missionary trip in a secret Muslim nation. I mean, the nation wasn't secret. It was only secret to you. You know, they knew where they lived. You get the deal. Okay. And, of course, how weird would that be? Okay. So, anyway, I'm on this team. I'm feeling unforgiveness towards this other guy. And, of course, I realize as I pray and do my, you know, whatever you do, every day with Jesus, I do every day with Jesus, so and he's, yeah, I'm doing that. I realize this is ridiculous. I have absolutely got to forgive him. And so I think, this is what I've got to do. I've got to forgive him. So I leave my prayer closet and I find him. And I say, hi, hi, I find you really difficult to be around. I think you're selfish, and I think your selfishness is really damaging this team. But I just wanted you to know, I forgive you. And he's like, great. Thanks so much. And he says, you know, it's really kind of you, Adrian, to share that with me. You know what? The other day, Adrian, I found this great verse in the Bible. It's about taking the plank out of your own eye before you try and take the speck out of somebody else's. You might want to check it out sometime. Okay. So when the other person does apologize, obviously it's so much easier. But in your case, the other person will never apologize because they don't think they've done anything wrong. They've got nothing to apologize for. Why should they? So how am I going to find the motivation to totally forgive? Thankfully, Jesus knows how carnal I am. And so Jesus appeals to my self-interest. He says, do not judge or you too will be judged. This is Matthew 7. He could have said, oh, don't judge people, Adrian, because it's wrong. But that doesn't motivate me enough because, you know, I'm too sinful for that. There are loads of things that I know that are wrong, and I do them anyway. Here, Jesus gives us a much more powerful incentive. He says, don't judge Adrian, or you too will be judged. And if, Adrian, you broadcast the information that you have about person X that most people don't know, I, the Lord your God, will broadcast the information I've got on you, Adrian, that most people don't know. And when God says that to me, I found it works. Yeah? And we are told to forgive as the Lord forgave you. How has the Lord forgiven me? Well, my sins will never, ever be held against me. Nobody will ever know what I've done. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Therefore, to forgive as the Lord forgave me means that I hold nothing against person X, and I don't use the information that I have on that person. Now, of course, at this point in our journey this evening, total forgiveness for some here probably seems totally unrealistic. So let's be clear. You don't have to approve of what they did to you. You don't have to excuse what they did to you. God is not asking you to kind of in some weird way forget what happened or pretend it didn't happen. No one is asking you to say, oh, actually, it wasn't that big a deal after all. You don't even have to be reconciled towards the other person, although, of course, Joseph was. That may be impossible. The other person may not want to speak to you. They may not even be able to speak to you. But what total forgiveness is you kissing goodbye forever to any thought, hope, prospect, or reality of revenge. Love keeps no record of wrongs. Now, I would say, in a crowd of this size, there are probably several marriages that could be improved tonight simply by a couple deciding, I will no longer choose to keep any record of wrongs. bring up the past. I will set my wife, I will set my husband totally free. And that means that, you know what happens is you say to your wife, oh, you know that thing that you did when we were going out? And she says, what? I can't believe you brought that up after all these years. You said you'd totally forgiven me. And you say, I did, but I've changed my mind. You're not allowed to do that, okay? All right, it says so in the marriage rule book. Go back and check it out. I forget the page number. It's in there somewhere. Joseph made no attempt to punish. He said, am I in the place of God? If there is a sin that needs to be punished, the Bible commands us to leave it entirely with God to punish. God is just, and one day every wrong will be righted and every sin will be judged appropriately. We are told to steer well clear and leave it all to God. Next is the high point. Joseph says, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what's now being done, the saving of many lives. This is the ultimate. Here, you not only forgive them, but you work hard to enable them to feel good about themselves. In this case, Joseph sets them totally free by showing that God has brought something wonderful out of the evil that they have done. Joseph here makes it easy for his brothers. What verse 20 says is, you planned evil against me, but God planned it for good so that millions of people who would otherwise have starved to death in this terrible famine have now been saved. This is one of the greatest explanations in the whole of the Old Testament of the sovereignty of God. God wins in the end. Joseph says, look, you guys planned evil, and you did evil, but God overruled it because God has got plans of his own. Or to be more precise, Joseph's saying, God actually used your evil plans and wove them into the sovereign plan of God himself. And that's what Paul is saying in Romans 8, 28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and who have been called according to his purpose. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that everything that happens is good. Of course not. What it means is that God's sovereign power is such that he can work even through the evil and wickedness that people do. Somebody says, but I've missed God's plan A to get me to my destiny. It's all gone wrong. I'm sure I was supposed to marry so-and-so from the youth group, but then when I was 17, I was in the gym at school, and this kid from the year below, he broke my collarbone, and that meant I missed the geography field trip, and that meant when it came to the exam, I couldn't answer the question about soil erosion, and that meant that I missed my grades to get into the same university as her, and then she went on this church plant. It was exactly the sort of church plant that I'd want to go on, but instead of being on the church plant, instead of being with her for the last 4 years, I'm stuck here every day knowing that if only I got an A in geography, I'd be married by now. Even if that were true, which I strongly suspect it isn't, God is big enough and clever enough to work through any circumstance to come up with a plan B and a plan C to get you to your destiny anyway. He's not thrown by your failure to get an A star in geography. Because he runs the universe. He thinks, aha, I'm sure I can come up with something. So here is the perspective that Joseph has got as an older man after walking with God for many years. God used your evil for his good. God, Joseph says, used me to save millions of people, including our family, who after all carry the promise of God given to Abraham, given to Isaac, given to Jacob, rather than starving to death in Israel, which would have made Genesis the last book in the Bible. Instead of that, we are alive and well, thanks to you lot sending me to Egypt. So Joseph says, guys, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't have wished for it. I wouldn't have wanted my life to go this way. But guys, with hindsight, I thank God for what he's done. I've seen millions of people saved. I get to feed them. I get to love them. And so here we see a great truth that ministry, like Joseph's ministry, comes out of pain and brokenness. I don't think I could have preached on unforgiveness when I was 25 years old. I don't think so. But I think I can now. So if this sermon is any good, it's because it's coming out of pain and brokenness. Because once we've been through that, we can comfort others with the comfort that we ourselves have received. And this, of course, is how we win others to Christ. You get brutally honest. If you've been through something hard, you've just got a golden ticket to connect with maybe 100,000 people who live in London who've been through the same thing, but they don't know Jesus yet. All you have to do is meet one of those 100,000 people that have been through what you went through, and they say to you, hey, that's interesting. Your story sounds a lot like my story. How did you get through it? And in your answer, you mention Jesus. And then, for the first time in their whole life, they say to you, that's interesting. How does Jesus help? A question they would never have asked had you not been through what you went through. Life really is a tapestry that God is weaving together. And from the bottom of the loom, from underneath, all we see is knots. Now, of course, if we were to come up higher and we look from the top, we see a glorious portrait of what God is doing. From above the loom, folks, the knots make sense. Joseph gets this moment of clarity in verse 20 where he peers above the loom and he sees that life is not actually all knots and mistakes. It's a tapestry. It just looks like knots from down here. But from where God is, this is working out into a beautiful portrait so that as many people as possible could be loved, served, and saved. Next he says, I will provide for you and your children. It's important because total forgiveness is when you actually want them to be blessed. You're not just getting it off out of your system. You actually want them to be blessed. The crowning glory of total forgiveness is loving action towards the offender. Joseph promises to practically provide for his brothers and their children. And this isn't just praying, Lord, please bless my brothers who ruined my life, amen. This is actually making their lives comfortable and paying money to look after the people who tried to kill you. That's what Joseph did. He paid money to look after the people who tried to kill them. And fifthly and finally, he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. So can I ask you, what is your response, if I may ask, to what you've heard tonight? For some of you here tonight, God is saying to you right now, you've dwelt long enough on this mountain. It is time to move on. It's time to let go of past hurts, pains, failures. Folks, God is just. He knows when people aren't treating us right. He sees every time that you've turned the other cheek and let an offense go by. And so tonight, it's time for you to come up higher. It's time for you to move to a new level. It's time to move up. It's time for you to achieve true greatness. To do something truly great in your life, to totally forgive. Don't hold on to grudges. You are a bigger and a better person than that. For my part, I came to realize that if I am bitter and resentful, it is because I am allowing myself to remain that way. Nobody, not even God, ever promised that life would be fair. There is absolutely no benefit to you in dwelling on what could have been, what should have been, or what might have been. Now, you may have deep scars and emotional wounds, but don't let your past determine your future. You can't do anything about what's happened to you, but you can choose how you will face what's in front of you. Don't hold on to feelings of bitterness and resentment and let them poison your future. Forgive the people who did you wrong and forgive yourself for the mistakes that you may have made. Now, here's the really tricky bit. Some of you may also need to forgive God. Now, what on earth do I mean by that? You may subconsciously have been blaming him, by implication, for allowing such and such to happen. But here's the truth. You'll never be truly happy as long as you harbor any bitterness in your heart. If you really want to move forward, you have to stop making excuses, stop blaming people or circumstances that disappointed you, and then start forgiving the people that hurt you. And today can be a turning point in your life. It can be a time of new beginnings. But why did such and such happen to me? You may never know the answer. But don't allow that as an excuse for you to remain in self-pity. We have to accept the fact that we have no right to expect a satisfactory answer from God to every question that we ever ask him. There will be unanswered questions. And just because you don't currently know the answer doesn't mean that no answer exists. It could be there is an answer, but you've simply not discovered it yet. Above the loom, you can see the answer. At the moment, it's not. We all have unfair and unjust things that happen to us. It is part of life. And when we are hurt, we have a choice to hold on to the pain and become bitter, or we can choose to let it go and trust God that he will make it up to us. The Bible tells us to make sure, Christchurch, that no root of bitterness grows up inside us. Because if you do, yourself and so many other people will become contaminated by it. Bitterness in the Bible is described as a root. Think about that. You can't see a root. That's why I'm preaching like this, to dig and dig and dig to get to the root of bitterness in your life. If it's there at all, I want to find it tonight. Because at the moment, it's deep down under the ground. It's a root. You didn't turn up to church with, hey, guess what? I've got bitterness deep down inside me and a little badge and a collar. But it's there. And be sure of this, a bitter root will produce bitter fruit. And if we have bitterness on the inside, it will end up contaminating everything that comes out of us. It will contaminate our personality and our attitudes, as well as how we treat other people. And so the Bible talks about being quick to forgive. Because the longer we hold on to resentment, the deeper the root of bitterness grows. And you may be listening to all this saying, man, life, I wasn't expecting this kind of a sermon. Adrian, I can't do it. You might be saying, I'll be totally honest with you, it's too hard. I can't forgive, at least not yet. They hurt me too badly. To which I would reply, wait a minute. You're not forgiving for their sake. You're forgiving for your sake. You are forgiving in order to get the life-threatening poison that is in your body out of your body so that you can lead a long, healthy, and happy life. God is asking you tonight to do yourself a favor. And when we live with grudges in our hearts, all we're doing is building walls of separation. Now, we think that, you know, that's being sensible and we're protecting ourselves, but actually we're not. We're shutting other people out of our lives and we're shutting the blessing of God out of our lives. And we become isolated and we become imprisoned. We become imprisoned by our own bitterness. But if you come up higher tonight, if you leave it with God, then you don't have to go around paying everybody back for the wrongs that they've done you and others. As if God's appointed you as kind of life referee. And you have to make sure everybody gets their just desserts and that nobody gets away with anything. Instead, you're not the referee. You leave it up to God. You take the high road. What a liberating way to live. Leave it to God. Live a life of unforgiveness, of forgiveness. God sees every wrong that's been done to you. He sees every person that's ever hurt you. He's keeping a record. And the Bible says that if you don't avenge yourself, God will reward you. And you know what? If you want to avoid getting trapped in your past, you must also learn to forgive yourself. You have to get beyond rehearsing your own failures in your mind. Oh, if only when I was 17 I hadn't shared those dreams, even though it was from God, even though God gave me those dreams, I wish I hadn't shared them with those brothers, or at least if I had shared them, I wish I hadn't done it in such an arrogant way, and then maybe they wouldn't chuck me in that cistern, and then I wouldn't have ended up going to Egypt, and then I wouldn't have been in prison. And at some point, Joseph must have thought like that, and at some point, he must have got beyond that. We know, because by chapter 50, verse 20, he was way beyond that. He'd forgiven himself for the mistakes that he made when he was younger. Tonight, I want to encourage you to follow Joseph's example. Don't let rejection fester inside you, poisoning your future. You may, at this moment, feel disqualified from God's best, convinced you must settle for second best for the rest of your life because of the poor decisions that you have made. But God has got a plan B. He has got a plan C for your life. And he'll get you to the destination that he has for you because God is on our side. Trials, temptations, difficulties, adversity, they must come because if we are ever to strengthen our spiritual faith muscles, we must have something to push against. I can't build up my faith muscles pushing against thin air. I need something. I need some weights. I need some resistance. I need a challenge if ever my faith muscles are to grow strong. And I am convinced that one day we will look back on what we considered at the time to be the worst thing that could possibly have happened to us, and we will realize that God used even that time of adversity to refine us, to mold us, to shape us, to prepare us for the good things that God has in store. Adversity often pushes us into our divine destiny. And it certainly did for Joseph. But Adrian, it's not fair. No, it's not. Life isn't fair. But we have to remember that God is the one keeping the score. He's in control. And when you bless your enemies, you will never lose. God will make it up to you. I'll finish with this. There's an interaction going on right now between you and God in your heart. There's one other interested party. He hates you. And he has a plan for your life. The devil is listening in. And the Bible says that the joy of the Lord is your strength. The devil's plan for your life is to take your joy. Best way to do that? A root of bitterness that never gets dealt with. A sermon like this that ends, no life change. Tonight, God is asking you to do yourself a favor and to forgive totally. I wonder if the band could come and join me. It was amazing to me as we were in the worship, the first reading we had from Charlie was from Acts 4 and verse 27. And it was all about exactly what we've been looking at tonight, but in the life of Jesus. If you've been there at the crucifixion of Jesus, the trial of Jesus, it looked like evil was given free rein. I mean, here's this totally innocent man. He's never done anything wrong. He's 33 years old. All he wants to do is love and bless people and speak truth. Yet he gets arrested for no good reason. He's put up on trial, false charges, spat at, arrested, crucified. He gets killed. Herod and Pontius Pilate conspired together, and when that travesty of a trial and that travesty of a crucifixion was going on, the disciples flee because they think, well, obviously God's deserted him. It's all gone wrong. Peter deserts him. They all run away. But they did what your power and will decided beforehand should happen. It was all planned. Every single thing on that crazy day when Jesus died, it was all part of God's plan. And you tonight may be looking at knots. You may be looking at a young holy man, a young preacher from Galilee, strung up on a cross. What's going on, Lord? He was supposed to be the savior of our nation. What's going on now? What's he doing up there on the cross? Disciples have deserted him. It's all gone wrong. No, it hasn't all gone wrong. You planned evil. Herod, you planned evil. Pontius Pilate, you may well have planned evil. You, Sanhedrin, you planned evil. But God planned it for good to accomplish what's being done right now in this church, the saving of many lives. We're commanded to forgive by Jesus. But how? You know, many Christians wait for, you kind of assume that people that are more spiritual and been Christians longer for you, they kind of have these feelings of forgiveness that come. The Holy Spirit comes. And then you feel like you want to forgive the other person. So you wait for that feeling, but it never comes. And so maybe that's why you haven't forgiven. Forgiveness isn't like that. Forgiveness starts with a decision, a cold blood decision. You don't feel anything. But you go through these stages. And I want to just take you through them in prayer tonight. Perhaps we could stand together. And I'd love to pray for you right where you are, actually. What I'd like you to do, if it's okay, is I'd just like all of you, if you would, just to close your eyes for a second. And I'd like you to think about this and then do it. I want you in a second to raise your hand if there is someone in this world, alive or dead, whom you have yet to totally forgive. And then I want to just pray for you. If there is bitterness in your heart towards a certain person, if there's resentment, if you know in your heart you've yet to totally forgive someone, I want you just to raise your hand right now. Up nice and high. Everyone else has got their eyes closed. In fact, even you've got your eyes closed. So wonderful. I want to just talk you through these stages. Do it in your mind. First of all, you don't have to say anything now, but in your mind, you may be able to say, I forgive you. These five stages. Firstly, Joseph said, don't be afraid. You can protect that person from their greatest fear, and you can kiss goodbye to revenge in your heart tonight. You can decide, I will never make them pay for what they did. That's the first step. Second step, in your heart, you're saying, am I in the place of God? You're deciding right now in this theater, you're going to leave it with God. You're going to leave the injustice of it all with God. You're not going to be the referee. You're going to let him judge. Third thing, and this is the best bit, in your heart, you can reassure yourself that God is still in charge. Yes, they planned evil. What they did was wrong. But God is able to use their evil and weave it into his sovereign plan so that from the top of the loom, it looks beautiful. You'd never know from the top of the loom the dramas of the knots below. I want to encourage you. You haven't missed your destiny. God is with you. Fourthly, when you see them, if you see them, act kindly towards them. Bless them in practical ways, just like Joseph did with his brothers. And fifthly, if you do speak to them, speak kindly to them so that they might never, ever know what's been going on in your heart. Leave it with God. You know, this is a holy moment because the life of Joseph so parallels that of Jesus. I believe God's going to minister to many hearts right now. Let's worship, shall we? Just come to God. Bring the feelings that you feel to a crucified Savior who never deserved such adversity.
Thanks for listening to the Christchurch London podcast. Do check out our website at www.christchurchlondon.org or come along and visit us at the Piccadilly Theatre in London's West End.